You're listening to a Bookmark podcast. For rights reasons, we've had to shorten or omit some of the music chosen by our guests, but we hope you still enjoy listening.
Bookmark with Lee Chambers on Cambridge 105 Radio.
With Heffer's Bookshop, the great Cambridge bookseller since 1876.
Our aspirations, rather than books.
Hello and welcome to Bookmark. This is the show that talks about books and writing with a local slant. Welcome back. This is the first in our new series and we've got a cracking show to kick off with. Our featured guest is best-selling author Ken Follett, here to talk about his new novel, The Evening and the Morning. We'll also hear from Paige Toon, chatting about her novel, The Minute I Saw You, and Wafa Tarnowska will be talking about her non-fiction book, Amazing Women of the Middle East. Ken, welcome to Bookmark.
Hi, it's great to be on the show.
It's lovely to talk to you. I'll give you a proper introduction in just a moment. But I suppose the theme that unites all our guests on this show is either they are at the top of the game or they're talking about people at the top of their game. And just doing my research on you, you've sold 170 million books and that figure increasing probably on a daily rate. When you started your writing career, did you ever imagine in your wildest dreams that you'd be looking at those sales figures?
I certainly didn't imagine that, but I did have high hopes. I was always quite ambitious and I wanted to write books for a big audience. I was never the kind of writer who wanted to write for a small, select, but very discriminating group. I wanted to tell stories to millions of people and I wanted to tell the kind of stories that I love. That was what pushed me. And of course, I did want to be a best-selling author and I wanted to be on the bestseller list. But the truth is, I certainly never imagined numbers like this. I'm very pleased about it. My wildest dreams were not quite this ambitious.
And I suppose the obvious question is then, what's your secret?
I think it's actually quite simple. If the reader shares the emotions of the characters in the story, so that the reader is scared when the characters are scared, and angry when they're angry, and hopeful when they're hopeful, then the reader's hooked. And if you can do that for readers, then they'll keep turning the pages. And at the end, they'll say, I've really enjoyed that. I wonder if he's written any others. And that, of course, is what keeps us going. If you can do that, if you can make the reader emotional about the story, then you've got a successful book. And if you can't do that, if you don't do that, all the other tricks that you might employ as a writer, trying to be witty, trying to be modern, writing in an experimental way, and so on, none of those things count for very much unless you've performed that one trick of drawing the reader into the story and making the reader care about it.
Has your writing changed, do you think, over the years? Or has your writing process changed?
The writing process hasn't changed very much since Eye of the Needle. When I developed the approach that I used for Eye of the Needle, which was my first successful book, at that point, I had hit on the method that worked for me. Eye of the Needle was the first book that I'd planned, and I realized then that planning the story was essential for me. It was the first book that I researched, and I realized that part of the appeal was the everyday detail of ordinary life in wartime Britain. And so I've always done a lot of research since then. And the final thing with Eye of the Needle was that I managed to slow my writing down. You know, I'd been a newspaper reporter, and so I was in the habit of writing very briskly. Short, sharp sentences. Give the reader the facts, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. And of course, that's not what you want in a novel. And I learned to, instead of just giving people the facts, give people the atmosphere, the feelings and the emotions. Those were really the three lessons I needed to learn before I could write a good book. And once I'd figured that out, my technique didn't change much.
Well, that was Eye of the Needle, your first book. We'll be talking a lot in the show about your new novel, The Evening and the Morning. But let's listen to your first choice of music now, which is Daft Punk and Lose Yourself in Dance. First of all, is music important to you, Ken?
Yes, it's always been, I don't just listen, I also play. I play bass guitar in a band, which is a marvelous thing to do, especially as it is so different from what I do all day. You know, writing popular fiction is quite cerebral. You're always plotting and planning. And really playing in a blues band is not cerebral at all. It's very sensory. I sometimes say that there's a connection between the ears and the fingertips that doesn't pass through the brain. And that's really what it's like. And of course, I don't know why we play so loud, but we do play incredibly loud, and you can't think in that kind of noise anyway. So you just do it. It's just instinctive. And that is so completely different from writing that I find it very relaxing.
And why this particular track? Why have you chosen this Daft Punk track?
Well, I love this track. It's very hypnotic. I can listen to it again and again. I don't mind how long it goes on, but it also sort of, it really sums up what dancing to pop music is all about. Lose yourself, you know, you just, it's the beat and the tune and the texture of the song, and you're moving to it, and that's what you do, you lose yourself. So I love the lyric too.
And that was Lose Yourself to Dance by Daft Punk, the first choice of music on Bookmark today from our featured guest, Ken Follett. Ken's first novel, Eye of the Needle, was published in 1978. It sold over 10 million copies and became an international bestseller. It was the first in a number of equally successful spy thrillers, culminating in Lie Down with Lions in 1986. Since then, Ken has dipped his toe into historical fiction, including two novels about World War II. His most popular novel, Pillars of the Earth, was published in 1989. It was on the New York Times bestseller list for 18 weeks and has sold more than 26 million copies worldwide. Set in the Middle Ages, it focused on the lives and conflicts of those involved in building a cathedral and spawned two sequels, World Without End and A Column of Fire. And now a prequel to the Kingsbridge trilogy, The Evening, The Morning, published this month. Expect pre-sales are doing very well, Ken. I enjoyed it very much, I must say.
Oh, thank you very much. I'm very pleased. People who've read it so far have really loved it, which, considering that I spent 2.5 years writing it, I'm very relieved about.
Well, you said yourself that Pillars of the Earth is your most popular novel. It's the one that people want to talk to you about when they meet you. Why do you think that is? Why has that captured people's imagination even more than your other novels?
It is a bit hard to say. It's a novel that depicts an entire society, the entire medieval society of England. And so it has that historical fascination on top of all the dramas in the story. But I think it's also partly because everybody who reads the book has at least seen a cathedral, and most of them have been inside one. Pretty much everybody who does that finds themselves asking a question, maybe two questions. Why was this built? And how was it built? Why did medieval people who didn't have much money want one of these? And how did they manage it with the very primitive technology at their disposal? How did they manage to build these enormous buildings that are still the most beautiful buildings in the world? The Pillars of the Earth promises an answer to a question that millions of people have asked themselves.
And when you originally thought about writing this and suggested writing it, your friends and advisors advised against it, didn't they?
Yes. You've got to understand that a publisher's life is full of risk. A publisher produces 100, 150 new products every year with really no way of knowing whether any of them are going to be successful. And one of the reasons that people like me are paid a lot of money by publishers is that we reliably produce something that people will enjoy. And so we give the publishers a little bit of stability and predictability. And then I, who have by that time had this reputation of being a reliable producer of popular books, turned around and said, I want to do something completely different. And they went, ah!
Why did you want to do something completely different?
Well, I didn't actually think of it as being that much different. I wanted to write a popular novel about the building of the cathedral. And I thought, when I thought about, well, what other book is it going to be like? I thought about Gone with the Wind, long historical novel and very detailed, at which people adored. I really knew that the idea was good enough for that. I didn't know whether I was good enough to write it, but I knew there could be a terrific popular novel about the building of a cathedral. It seemed to me manna from heaven. So to some extent, the publishers were frightened of something that wasn't going to happen. And I think they were frightened that I would be like the clown who wants to play Hamlet. I would be trying to do something that was absolutely out of my métier. And I didn't want to do that. I wanted to write a novel that had a lot of the appeal of those earlier thrillers. There would be love stories in it. And there's action, there's conflict, there's fighting. So page by page, it wasn't that different from anything I had done before. But the overall effect was, in fact, completely different. But I've got to give the publishers credit. None of them said, well, you can bog off now, Ken. We're finished with you. Go find another publisher. They all said, well, all right, if you're sure. And some of them sort of hinted that after I had done this, I could go back to writing good books again. And of course, in the upshot, everything was fine.
So here we are some time later, and you're writing a prequel. Why a prequel?
First of all, because people now really like stories about Kingsbridge, which is interesting. It actually has its own fan club. And I've begun to use Kingsbridge as a symbol for England. So the three books I've written set in Kingsbridge show England at different stages. So when I wrote about the Black Death in World Without End, I set the book in Kingsbridge, and it's about how Kingsbridge people dealt with the Black Death, something that has tragically become even more interesting with the arrival of COVID-19, because really the Black Death was a pandemic, very like COVID-19, but worse. And then in A Column of Fire, I wanted to write about the terrible religious wars of the 16th century, and I thought, well, one of the things I can do in this story is show what those wars meant to the people of Kingsbridge.
And so what was it like going back to Kingsbridge, going back to the time? How easy was it for you to rewind to before the Pillars of the Earth started?
Well, it was great fun, actually, because I thought, you know, this is a great city in the other books, but now I've got to imagine it as something less than that. What was it? Was it maybe just a village, maybe even less, maybe a hamlet? What went on that made it grow into this great city? How did that happen? What did people do? We know, don't we, that whenever there's change, there's conflict, because some people want the change and some people want everything to stay as it's always been. So I could see that there would be stories to tell about that development. And then the other thing was, I was looking back to around about the year 1000, which is a very dramatic and violent moment in the history of England. There were three great powers in conflict over who was going to rule England: the Anglo-Saxons, the Vikings, and the Normans. A three-way contest, it always has lots of potential for good stories, because one and then the other and then the third can seem to be ahead of the game and then fall back. And so those two things, the power struggle and the development of a village into a town and a city, they were both really good sources of drama. Once I'd figured that out, I was very keen to write it.
How do you address the issue of writing about that period of time, such a long way back, with a current sensibility, a modern sensibility towards things like polygamy, church corruption, which at that time were more accepted and more a way of life than certainly they are now?
Well, I think basically people haven't changed in 1,000 years. Of course, our life has changed. Our lifestyle has changed. Everything around us has changed. But actual human beings haven't evolved much. We're not that different from what we were 1,000 years ago. So if I think about something like polygamy, I think basically people's attitudes to that are going to be not that different than they are today, in that it will cause tensions. Even though it's accepted by the church and all the noblemen have more than one wife, and there is going to be resentment and people are going to be made unhappy by these arrangements, even though they're socially accepted. Somebody will say, this is the way it's always been done. What are you whinging about? And the other person will say, I just don't like it. I think actually you can adapt the feelings of 21st century people just very slightly, and you can show their reactions to completely different ways of life. You can actually imagine them really quite easily. Slavery is another example. It was quite shocking to discover that Anglo-Saxon England was a slave society. Something like 10% of the population were slaves. We can imagine what reactions are to that. There will be some people who will be very cruel. There will be some people who are kind. There will be some people who make excuses. Modern attitudes will not be that different from attitudes at the time. Some adjustments, yes, but our basic feelings, our sympathy for other human beings, for example, our need to be loved, these things haven't changed. And I think they were just as powerful 1,000 years ago as they are now.
Thank you, Cameron. We'll come back to you in just a moment to talk more about the evening and the morning. But let's stay in the present day, or discussing present day issues, and hear from Paige Toon. Sunday Times bestseller Paige is the author of 17 novels, which have sold 1.5 million copies worldwide. Her latest, The Minute I Saw You, was published last month and has already topped the Apple book chart. When I spoke to Paige via Zoom, I asked her to tell me what it's about.
This is the story of Hannah and Sunny. Hannah is a dispensing optician who spends her working life staring into the eyes of complete strangers. And one day a very hot stranger comes into the shop and his name is Sunny. And there's a spark between them when they're sort of very up close and personal, staring into each other's eyes. Hannah is someone who doesn't do relationships, but she's thinking when he comes back in to pick up his glasses, you know, maybe something will come of it. But when he comes back in, he's like a shadow of his former self. He can't meet her eyes at all. And something terrible has happened to him. And you sort of find out, basically, he doesn't do long-term relationships either. He can never form a lasting relationship. So he decides to take a vow of abstinence. So for at least sort of 6 months to a year, he's sworn himself off sex. This basically puts to bed any plans that, that's a terrible turn of phrase to use in this situation, but this puts to bed any plans that Hannah had of, you know, kind of having a quick fling. But over time, they sort of get to know each other and become friends. And there's always this sort of delicious sort of chemistry between them, but they can't do anything about it. And the entire book is set in Cambridge and Grantchester, with a couple of like little holidays off to Amsterdam and Australia. But on the whole, it's like my love letter to my to where I live.
Yeah, so I was going to say, why did you set it in Cambridge? Have you set any other novels here? Yeah.
My sixth book, One Perfect Summer, which I wrote about 8 years ago, that is half set in Cambridge. And I moved to Cambridge, the family and I moved to Cambridge, at the point in the story that my heroine had also moved here. And so I was doing lots of research about Cambridge and the colleges and, you know, punting and all sorts of, you know, stuff that made it into the book. And it was magical for me because I go to so many different places, so many different countries to research my books. And, you know, you always feel like they're a little piece of home, you know, in a way, because I've got to know the places and imagined being inside the heads of my heroines and living there. But with Cambridge, I got to stay, which was really just so, so lovely. And I just felt like revisiting it, you know, after all these years, writing about the sort of things that I love doing, you know, like going on pub crawls throughout Grantchester, you know, canoeing on the Cam, going to the orchard for cream teas, and just hanging out in Cambridge generally, you know, swimming in the river and stuff like that, you know. So it's kind of a perfect sort of English summer setting, a little bit of joy in these odd times.
This is your 17th novel. So is the Cambridge of your 17th novel different to the Cambridge of your 6th novel?
Yes, the Cambridge of my 6th novel. My character, Alice, she was going to Anglia Ruskin University. Her boyfriend was going to Trinity College in Cambridge. So that was written very much from a student's sort of perspective, what it's like to sort of live in Cambridge then. So this here is more 20-somethings, you know, who are hanging out. I think it's a little more fun. I mean, I loved writing about Cambridge as a student. It really made me wish that I'd gone and done an English literature degree at Anglia Ruskin myself, you know, and the punting on the river and stuff. But it was a younger crowd, whereas this is more sort of kind of late 20s, early 30s, you know.
And as I said, this is your 17th novel. How has the process changed for you over these years? Has it changed?
I always write my books really quickly, and certainly to start off with, that was something that I had to do out of necessity, because I stupidly suggested to my publisher that I write the book in 3.5 months while I had a full-time job and publish it the following spring. And then the second book that I wrote, I was pregnant and really was desperately trying to get the book finished before the baby came, and ended up shredding the 50,000 words that I'd written and writing another 100,000 in, again, 2 months during baby nap times. I've just sort of discovered over time that actually, while I might have a year effectively to write my next book, I tend to always write them in the last 3 months. That's my kind of key time. Something about writing in summer I find really hard. You know, my head feels like cotton wool. Whereas, you know, so September, October, November, that's always, I just feel like that's when I'm really creative. So I tend to do that. And just in terms of my writing, I think it's just improved over the years. You know, I've been writing now for 14 years. Three of the books you mentioned are young adult books, spin-off of my adult series. So I was doing 2 books a year for a while. But yeah, you know, I just think I've sort of matured as a writer and got better.
And you've sold over 1.5 million copies worldwide, which is fantastic. Congratulations. When you write, do you have a reader in your head?
I write for myself, and I've always written for myself. I write the books that I would love to read. I think that's so important, because whatever you're doing, if anyone out there is wanting to write, you can't write and imagine what people are going to think of it. You have to just write and love it, you know. And I've just found time and time again that there's a readership out there who love the way that I write. So I don't try to write for a certain audience, because I'd probably fail. You know, I just have to hope that as long as I'm writing with conviction, then, you know, people will come along for the ride.
And I think when last time we talked, which was many years ago, we had a discussion about chick lit and how you're marketed. And I'm just wondering if the perception of chick lit, or even chick lit itself, that word has changed since we last talked. Has it been reclaimed somehow, or does it even exist anymore?
People still definitely use it. I think it's just become such a dirty word, which is such a shame, you know, because I think I never had an issue with it, because, you know, for me, it's just sort of kind of young women's fiction. My readers are predominantly, you know, age sort of 15 to 40, you know, and that's all it means. I don't think it means anything derogatory as such. If you're thinking that the term chick lit only applies to books that are really complete fluff, you know, that take, you know, no time whatsoever or thought to write, then that's just plain untrue. I mean, my books are not just fluff, you know, like if anyone's picking this up just thinking this is going to be the lightest read you'll ever sort of read, you'll be disappointed, because this is probably both the darkest and the lightest book I've ever written. There's some real dark themes in here, and I don't always write happy endings, you know, like it's not just all hearts and flowers and very predictable from the beginning to the end. Some of my books are predictable, but hopefully the ride and the, you know, the journey that you go on along with a reader is just really enjoyable. I like to write the sort of books that are as easy as sitting down to watch an amazing film, you know, like a fantastic sort of film that you'll just really feel like you're inside those characters' heads, sort of experiencing what they're experiencing and getting to kind of live vicariously through them. So, you know, hopefully that's how readers will feel when they read them.
And what happens to these characters when you finish the novel? Are they still with you? How do you let them go?
I don't let them go. You know, I remember my husband saying to me, you know, you should probably, you know, before you start doing all of these, you know, I've been doing quite a lot of virtual online talks lately. And he said, you know, do you not think you should like go back over your books and refamiliarize it? And I'm like, oh, no, I do not need to. I literally remember every single journey that every single one of my characters have been on, because they feel like friends. My actual real friends laugh at me because I talk about these people as though they're real, you know, when I'm telling them what the book's about and stuff. So I don't ever let them go, because I've actually written 18 full-length novels, because my 18th book was a collection of short stories, and they're all mini sequels and spin-offs of the books that I've written. So, you know, in my head, I'm still thinking even now about what my characters are doing, you know, during this worldwide pandemic, for example. And, you know, there are a couple of characters that I'd love to write a short story for, you know, sort of experiencing this at the moment.
And I can hear the enthusiasm in your voice, so I don't even really need to ask this question, but obviously you're still loving writing and being a writer.
Absolutely. I mean, it was a job I always wanted to do as a kid, and it has so far exceeded my expectations, and I can't imagine ever stopping, even if my readers dried up, which I hope they never do. But I think I'd always want to write, you know, I'd always want to be kind of living vicariously through these characters doing, you know, sometimes very ordinary, sometimes slightly extraordinary things.
And there's always an element of romance in your novels. Are you a romantic person?
Absolutely. I've just done recorded an interview with one of my fellow authors called Lindsay Kelk. And she asked me if I could dig out my old diaries and like read a couple of excerpts through there. And my goodness, you know, starting from the age of 10, I mean, I sound so much like my daughter now, it's ridiculous. The amount of boys I was falling in and out of love with, you know, it's just, I've been a romantic, I think, as soon as I knew what love was, or what my idea of it was anyway. I'm sure they were just crushes.
And what next for you? Another novel, I'm guessing, in the autumn months?
Yep, that's right. I haven't started writing it yet because I've just been thinking about it. Even though I only write them quite quickly, you know, I'm thinking about them for a good year, and in this case, even longer. Everything's just really formulating inside my head, you know. I go for walks and come up with different scenes that I'm looking forward to writing, and, you know, eventually I'll just sort of come to sit down and just get everything out of my head and onto paper. So that's the plan.
And writing can be a very solitary activity, and particularly during lockdown, during this recent lockdown. Have you managed to get some support from other writers? You mentioned another writer there. Is there still that writing network that provides support?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's such a strong network on Twitter and Facebook. You know, people are always commenting on each other's posts, and, you know, I've done a couple of events with the authors. I've got some more coming up, some really exciting ones, you know, due to be announced soon. It's always been a very supportive network, and that has probably only got more supportive through this pandemic. I'm really glad I haven't had to write at this point, because I think I would have found that incredibly difficult with homeschooling and, you know, having the kids around. I like to be mum when the kids are at home. So fingers crossed it'll be a bit more of a return to normality in September. Otherwise, it's going to be a bit of a stressy 3 months. I'll be wishing that I'd given myself a full year.
And The Minute I Saw You by Paige Toon is published by Simon & Schuster. We're talking today on Bookmark to Ken Follett about his new novel, The Evening and the Morning, a prequel to Pillars of the Earth. Ken, Paige there saying she finds it difficult, if not impossible, to leave her characters behind. What about you? Over the years, you've created, well, hundreds, if not thousands of characters. You must have to leave them behind or you go mad, surely.
Yes. Yes, I know a lot of authors say they become quite attached to their characters. And of course, I do like some of them and hate some of them. But, you know, I spend generally something like 3 years with them. And when I finish the book, I'm very ready to write another one. People say to me, I suppose you take 6 months off after you finish a book. I say, absolutely not. I do try to take a fortnight off, but it doesn't really work. And after about 10 days, I find myself working on the next book. Is that so surprising? This is the most interesting thing in my life. I love doing it and I'm good at it. So I want to move on. I've usually got an idea for the next book. I'm excited about it. If it's the idea I've decided to run with, then I love it. If I don't love it, I'll think of something else. So at that point, I'm keen to create a new set of characters and put them together and have them in conflict and in love. I'm keen to get into that. So I don't have a problem leaving characters behind.
What is it you love about it? I'm going to hear in your voice how much you love writing. What is it in particular? Can you pin it down?
It's a good question, Lee. I don't have a very pat answer to that. It's partly because it's challenging. Even after all these years, it's difficult to write a good book, and I rewrite a lot. But I plan. That planning saves me from a lot of mistakes. But sometimes the story takes a wrong turn and I just have to go back and take out 40 or 50 pages and throw them away. But spotting that is key. Writing it and thinking, now, this isn't as exciting as I thought it was going to be. What's wrong? And just thinking about it and going back and saying, okay, that's a thread of the story that just never catches fire, so I'm throwing it away. That kind of thing. It's the exercise of my craft.
How do you manage it all? Because lots of your books are very long. Certainly this one is very long. How do you keep track of where you are in the story and where the characters are in the story when you've got so many words?
The plan, the outline, helps enormously. And the way I'm working now is I have three screens. And in the middle screen is what I'm writing at this minute. And on the left-hand screen is the outline of the story that I wrote before I started. And on the right-hand scene is a spreadsheet that has all the characters and how old they are and what they look like. I cut and paste the descriptions of characters for very practical reasons, so that I don't give somebody blue eyes in chapter 3 and brown eyes in chapter 10. Also to help me keep track. And then you want to minimize the number of characters. You don't want to give the reader too much to memorize. So if I'm bringing in a new character, I often look back and say, instead of creating a new character, can I use somebody who's already appeared that the reader already knows? And whenever I can, I do that. So really, I have those two aids to memory, the spreadsheet of the characters and the outline of the story. And that pretty much helps me.
That outline is crucial to you then. You must spend a lot of time on that outline, and B, you stick to it. It never changes.
It doesn't change much. I said a moment ago that sometimes I get the sense that something is going wrong. It's not as good as it ought to be. And I'll go back and it'll be something that's in the outline. And I thought it was going to be great. And it hasn't quite turned out that way. And I'll take it out. So yes, I do sometimes take out things that aren't working. And I quite often make new connections between characters and events that I didn't anticipate when I was writing the outline. If I have to make a major change and I have to go back over the last 400 pages and make 50 or 60 alterations or throw lots of pages away, it's a bit of a pain. If it needs doing, I do it. But usually the plan is good enough that I don't need to do that.
Well, let's listen to your second choice of music now, which is Park Life by Blur. Why this one?
I love this number, and we play it in the band. We're all playing, but one person singing, and then we all call out Park Life in the chorus. And I really enjoy playing it. And if it's a good gig, then the people on the dance floor are all shouting it out as well. So it's the best fun.
Confidence is a preference for the habitual voyeur of what is known as a morning suit can be avoided if you take a route straight through what is known as John Scott.
Bookmark with Lee Chambers on Cambridge 105 Radio.
With Heffer's Bookshop, the great Cambridge bookseller since 1876.
Our aspiration.
And our guest on Bookmark today is Ken Follett, talking about his new novel, The Evening and the Morning. Ken, I was struck when I read the novel by, even though we're talking many, many years ago, what, 10th and 11th century, some of the issues were very similar to those that are being discussed today. I mean, we've mentioned earlier about slavery and human trafficking.
Isn't it depressing to think that this stuff is still going on? People are still being treated in this way. At least it's illegal in most countries now. It's still going on, but at least it is against the law. And of course, in Anglo-Saxon England, it wasn't against the law. And actually, through most of history, in most countries and most societies, slavery has not been against the law. The other issue, which I think is very relevant, is one of the things that people are beginning to demand in the year 1000 is what we call the rule of law. So that when there's a trial and a court and a lawsuit, the decision is made according to the law. Now, back in the Dark Ages, the decision was made by the local chieftain. He was called an elderman, and he always sided with his family. So it wasn't really justice in the modern sense of justice, but people were beginning to demand that. And one of the things we see is how awful life is when the law isn't enforced as the law, but is just at the mercy of somebody's preferences and favoritism. We take for granted the rule of law, but in many countries now, it's no longer taken for granted. Poland, for example, where the government is trying to reduce the power of the judges because they don't like somebody having the right to decide things. They want to be like medieval chieftains and decide according to their own preferences rather than according to the law. And President Trump has shown great contempt for judges and the legal process. So actually, the rule of law is now under attack. I didn't begin this book with the intention of making that point, but I think, like it or not, the book makes the point that if you don't have the rule of law, you are much worse off.
How do you think you would have fared in those times?
Oh, dear. There wasn't much demand for storytellers. And, you know, I would be a hopeless farmer. I don't know what the opposite of green fingers is, but that's what I've got. I wouldn't have been any good as a soldier. I'm quite small. I've never been a tough guy, you know. And I'm not all that keen on religion. Not that I'm not a spiritual person, but I don't really believe in any organized religion. So I would have been a bit out of place in the church. So what would I have done? I suppose I might have been a traveling poet with a lyre in a sack on my back. But somehow I don't fancy that much either.
They were brutal and precarious times, but the character that really appealed to me, I loved all the characters in the book, but I really enjoyed Ragna because she's a woman who manages to survive despite being a woman, because the rights of women at that time were almost non-existent. Physically, financially, she's made of strong stuff. Where did she come from?
She really is an example of a character that appears in most of my books, I'm afraid. There is usually a woman in the story who rebels against convention, who won't do what people tell her to do, and is smart and sexy and feisty. And of course, I write women like that because I like women like that. So if I'm going to create a heroine, I'm going to create somebody of the type that appeals to me. That's where Ragna comes from. People sometimes say about these women in my stories, is that really historical? I think that in any society, in any period of history, there are people who rebel against the conventions, people who refuse to accept the role that society wants them to perform. And of course, they're the most interesting people to write a story about. And Ragna is one of those. She's my favorite character in The Evening and the Morning. And that's probably why she has to make her way through so much hardship in the story before she finally gets what she needs.
Yes, some not very nice things happen to her. We won't give away what, but how did that feel, doing that to your favourite character?
Well, you know, it's part of the story. Every love story is Romeo and Juliet. Two people want to be together, but they can't. If two people fall in love and get married and live happily ever after, that's not a story. There's no drama there. So the people we like have to meet with problems and troubles, difficulties and crises. And that's what the story is about. It's about how they overcome them or maybe don't overcome them at times. And we're involved in that because we see them striving to overcome these setbacks and we want them to succeed. And we're glad when they do and we're sorry when they fail. That's what storytelling is all about.
Thank you, Ken. Well, let's stay on the subject of women and hear from Wafa Tarnowska. She's a translator and storyteller. She's written several books for children, reimagining or retelling Arabian and Persian fables and tales. Her non-fiction book, Amazing Women of the Middle East, is published this month. Wafa told me what it's about.
It's about 25 amazing women. There would have been so many more women if we wanted to, but we had to choose 25, which was a difficult choice because there are some amazing women in the Middle East, despite what the media wants to tell you. They want to tell you that women in the Middle East are downtrodden, under the thumb, unable to flourish or do things. Now, the laws in the Middle East are not always conducive to women's freedom, but I think women in the Middle East have fought and won and done some amazing things. And I very much wanted to show this to the reader that, you know, women are doing things despite all the restrictions and constrictions.
And what was your criteria for being amazing?
My criteria for being amazing is basically succeeding in fulfilling your dream. And the dream didn't have to be just being a queen, because a lot of people, when they talk about amazing, it's usually a queen or an activist or somebody really big name. It's basically somebody who sets her mind onto doing something and she achieves it and happens to succeed in it. The other criteria is that these women are doing things outside the normal professions that usually women are allowed to do. So we've got a pilot, an astronomer, a person who is an amazing genius, mathematical. So it's not just about being a celebrity. Some people, you don't even know they exist, but they are celebrities in their own right, in their field.
Yes, there are some names I recognize. You've got names like Scheherazade there, Nefertiti, right up to the present day, people like Amal Clooney, and then other names that I wasn't familiar with. So that's presumably part of your motive as well, about raising the profile of these women.
Completely. Not only I wanted various professions, so to broaden the mind of the people reading the book is that you can do anything you want, but I also wanted these women to come from various parts of the Middle East. So that's why it spans from Turkey to Morocco, because we only get the negative. And I really, really wanted to show the positive.
And some of these women are from a long way back. How did you find out about them? Did you already know about them, or were you researching?
No, I knew about them because my passion in life is myths and legends, and I've been doing myths and legends for 20 years. So I feed on it. It's like my manna. Shahrazad is my, let's say, heroine of all times. I'm a storyteller. In addition to being a writer, I go around telling stories, and she's the most famous storyteller on the planet because she kept a guy interested in her stories for 3 years and kept herself from being killed because of her incredible creativity and knowledge and culture. She's a mythical figure. We don't know whether she existed or not, but she's so famous. Nefertiti, she and her husband, they were the first people who established kind of the idea of a monotheistic religion, because before that, people had many, many, many gods to worship, but they concentrated their people on worshiping the sun god. People don't know that very much. I mean, they know the bust in Berlin, that she's stunningly beautiful, but they don't know what she actually did. And she was an equal to her husband. Another one whom I absolutely adore, to be honest, is Rabi' al-Adawiyya. She is a mystic, Sufi saint. And straight after Muhammad, she rose up to start this religion of love. Love is what is the guiding principle, which is now, 1,200 years later, you pay money for self-help book to teach you about love. This woman was saying, my religion is love. And she was writing these love poems to God. The modern ones, if I would be one of them, I would be Azza Fahmi. She's Egyptian jewelry maker. I love this woman because she started becoming a jewelry maker, which is a field where men usually excel. And I love jewelry. I've loved her work. And just writing about her and researching about her, if I could be one, I would be Azza Fahmi in the modern world.
And who's this book aimed at? What's the reader? Who do you want to see opening this book?
Well, I'd like it from 9 to 14-year-old girls and maybe boys and their mothers. I just think it's a very, very interesting thing to start a dialogue between girls and their mothers or even their teachers, because we lack role models. In the West, we might have more role models than in the East. Having role models is very, very important, as I say in my introduction, because role models make you not want to copy, but open your horizon as, this is possible. If this person did it, maybe I can do it. And I think we need to have more books for role models for girls. None has been done about the Middle East role models. I know a few have been done about the West role models and the Asian role models, but not the Middle East. So in that sense, we're pioneering.
And is there one of the women in particular that you feel that you've learned something from?
The one that touches me incredibly is Salwa Rauda Shukair, who became famous at the age of 97, I think. For me, it means you should never give up. I mean, this woman worked for 60 years producing stunning art and only got discovered by Tate Modern in the last few years of her life. And her daughter, who's also an artist, took over all her foundation. She collaborated with her Tate on sending all the stuff that her mother produced for 60 years in obscurity to the Tate. And she had this exhibition, which I saw, and it blew my mind about how this woman was so forward-thinking, so determined. I mean, she worked under the war. She worked under the bombs, and some of her stuff, you see when you see the exhibition, got hit by shrapnels. But she continued, and she didn't give up on her dream. And now her stuff is touring the world, but at 94. That for me is a huge example of not giving up until the day you die.
And what's next for you? Now this book is out, what's next for you? Promoting it, but what's next on your agenda?
No, I'm writing a new book. and it's about not giving up. This is the first time I'm going to write. I mean, I've done 6 children's books and 2 books of quotes. Translation is my bread and butter, and I'm working on a translation for the BBC at the moment. But I've been researching for a year and writing about not giving up, because, as you know, I come from a bit of a difficult background, and since I have experienced war as a child and I have been a refugee, so I've had to have a lot of obstacles to overcome. And I thought it is nice maybe to share some of these experiences. And it's the first time I will be writing a book for grown-ups. I'm not talking about 50 Shades of Grey grown-ups. I'm talking about women, men our age who, you know, maybe sometimes say, oh, I'm too old to do this, I'm too old to do that. That's why Salwa is so important for me, because you're never too old. And I want to write that book. And this is what I'm working on in this COVID time.
And Amazing Women of the Middle East by Wafa Tarnowska is published by Piku Publishing. My guest on Bookmark today has been Ken Follett, here to talk about his book, The Evening and the Morning, which is published by Macmillan. Well, for talking there, Ken, about who inspires her and impresses her, who inspires you?
I learned to read when I was age 4 because I wanted to read the Noddy books by Enid Blyton. I loved stories, and I got my parents to read to me, and I had 4 grandparents and lots of uncles and aunts, and they all read to me. They were all very good, and it was never enough, because they'd read one story or maybe 2, and then they say, that's enough for today, Ken. And I go, no, I want another one. And that was my motivation for learning to read. My mother must have taught me to read. So Enid Blyton seduced me into the lifelong habit of enjoying fiction. And then when I was 12, I discovered James Bond. And I just adored those books. When I started trying to write novels myself, I thought of how thrilled I had been to hold in my hand a new James Bond book. And I thought, that's what I've got to give people. That's what it's about. I'm always very conscious of how many other forms of entertainment are easily available to my readers, but I want them to pick up my book. So I've got to offer them quite an intense level of enjoyment. And I think about that level of pleasure that I found in those James Bond books. And I still think, actually, you know, am I giving my readers the feeling that I used to have when I was a young teenager and I had a new James Bond book?
And how do you decide whether you are?
I think the main thing for me is never being satisfied with something that is just okay. It's very tempting, you know, you've written 5 pages and you think, well, it never really catches fire, but, you know, it gets us from this point of the story to that point of the story, so maybe it's okay. And that's when I have to discipline myself and say, look, if you want 10 million people to read this book, it's got to be better than okay. And I also seek criticism. You know, I like editors who tell me what's wrong with the book. Given the situation I'm in, editors are sometimes a bit frightened to do that. And I have to say to them, look, don't tell me I'm a genius. That's no help to me at all. What I need you to say is something like, you know, this chapter's a bit boring. I wonder why. Or I never really liked that character. Couldn't you make that character a bit more appealing? And then we can have a discussion about it. I don't necessarily do what they tell me to do, but I do figure if they're dissatisfied with something, there probably is something wrong. Even if the editor hasn't put her finger exactly on what it is that's wrong, there'll be something wrong there that I need to fix. So it's a bit like being a perfectionist. It's not being nitpicking. Actually, the nitpicking aspect is quite important, because if you make mistakes, readers notice and it pops them out of the story. But the main thing is not to be satisfied with something that's below par.
And what's next for you then, Ken? You've had your 10 days off, presumably some time back when you finished.
Yes, I'm working on a new story and I'm well advanced in it. I'm not talking about it yet, partly because I want to talk about The Evening and the Morning, and it's going to be a long time before this book is in the shops, but also because I might say something about it now that turns out not to be true. It's a long way from being finished, and it could change, and it might change a lot.
And a question that we ask all our guests on Bookmark, what are you reading at the moment? What's on your bedside table?
I'm reading a book called Le Train, which is by Simenon. It's in French. I enjoy reading in French. I read fairly simple literature, but Simenon, who created Maigret, writes very easily understandable prose. Le Train is great because it's set at the beginning of the Second World War, and the hero and his family live near the Belgian border, and they flee from the Germans when the Germans invade France. And they get on a train, and the novel is the story of their journey on this train. I like Simenon. He's kind to foreigners whose French is far from perfect, as mine is.
Thank you, Ken. We'll come back to you for your last choice of music in just a moment. But just a heads up, that our next show featured guest is poet Lachlan McKinnon. We'll also be talking to Jonathan Schneer about his non-fiction book, The Lockhart Plot. And Sarah Martin will be discussing her whimsical musings and conversations with Nell. But we'll sign out now, Ken, with your last choice of music, Walk the Moon and Shut Up and Dance. Why this one?
It's a great tune, but I love the lyric. And of course, she is saying it to him. He's kind of awkward and he's trying to chat her up. And she goes, shut up and dance with me, which I think is great. It's very romantic. If I'd thought of it first, I would have put it in a novel.
Oh, don't you dare look back, just keep your